Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Each spring brings forth the realization that Major League Baseball organizations and players have odd relationships with non-cis male fans. This week, Blue Jays' Josh Donaldson tweeted on International Women's Day, claiming that if Saturdays are for the boys is sexist, so too is International Women's Day. What are our thoughts on Josh Donaldson's statement, and why is he so wrong?
I mean, it's just, like, why would you tweet that? Like, even if you think that, but I guess, I mean, if you think that, then you don't have enough sense to realize that you shouldn't at least tweet it. But anyway, yeah, it was a mess.
Yeah, for anybody listening who isn't aware of what Saturdays Are For the Boys is, it's essentially the slogan of Barstool Sports. And have we talked about Barstool on here? I think we try to avoid talking about Barstool too much because that would just be us yelling for an entire hour. And I don't know that anyone actually wants to listen to that. But basically, the statement maybe didn't have bad origins originally, but now it's become this thing where it's like, gotta get away from the ball and chain for a weekend to go spend time with my boys. And it's just like, okay, is this the 1950s? Like, do we still believe that spending time with women is that intolerable? Like, I don't know, whatever. Like, go hang out with your guy friends, it's fine. But it doesn't have to be like a thing where you have like a designated day of the week where women and anyone who's not a man is not allowed. So that's what that statement is, and that's why, you know, he was tweeting about the statement. People called him out on the fact that he was tweeting about that and that it was International Women's Day. The original tweet's been deleted, so I don't even really know what it said. But then he's like, oh, well, if this statement is sexist, then so must International Women's Day be, because, you know, you're being exclusionary, except people didn't use the word exclusionary. I don't know that Josh Donaldson knows the word exclusionary, in part because he kept spelling sexist as sexiest. and that may have just been an autocorrect thing. But the thing is, he did it multiple times. And I'm like, how are you not catching this every time? So I don't know. It at least brought some levity to a kind of frustrating situation. Because I was like, okay, you're saying things that are really, really dumb, but you're also saying sexiest instead of sexist. And that makes it funny, at least.
I've got a screenshot of the original tweet, which is at Barstool Sports, so does hashtag National Women's Day go from being celebrated on a Friday to the next year celebrated on a Sunday? We know what Saturdays are for.
Ah, that's it.
I mean, Donaldson does have a little bit of a reputation of tweeting before he thinks. I guess that's the nicest way to put it. In 2014, he tweeted about the Oakland A's front office, and you know, as a lot of people know, Donaldson used to play for Oakland, and he said to a now locked account, so I can't really see the full context, "They have plenty of money, my friend. They just tell everyone they don't." So yeah, there was an article from Hardball Talk from 2014 about how the Donaldson trade was reportedly sparked by an argument with Billy Bean, in which Donaldson petulantly calling Bean Billy Boy, apparently. And that was quoting a Bleacher Report article. So Donaldson, while I would say that it's not surprising that he would, you know, talk about how Saturdays are for the boys, it almost seems like it would be too expected from him, considering a reputation of possibly not being the greatest dude in the clubhouse. So,
yeah, and I mean, his statement just obviously exhibits a fundamental misunderstanding of what International Women's Day stands for in relation to every single other day of the year. So he's got some things to learn in that area.
Yeah, and Susan Slusser, you know, Nate's beat writer, she pointed out to him that there's an International Men's Day as well, which, you know, one of the favorite arguments of people who seem to care so much about, you know, representation of men, but only when it, you know, comes to representation of women. They always like to point out, like, oh, what about International Men's Day? It's like, there is an International Men's Day, and it's in, I think it's in November. And, like, you know, that would be a great time to, like, bring awareness to causes that actually affect men, because there are plenty. And, you know, there's, you could use that as a way to do a lot of good, but no, you just want to petulantly point out that women are getting representation, and I don't like that.
Yeah. I was also going to say, you know, International Men's Day is in November, like Sarah said, and that's also the month of Movember, which is where when a lot of guys who can grow facial hair decide to grow facial hair, and it's committed to, and it's, quote, the Movember Foundation is a leading global organization committed to changing the face of men's health. So, you know, there's a lot of good causes attached to International Men's Day and the month of November when it comes to men and health. But let's have women have their day, considering that men usually get their day every other day of the year. So it's not hard to just kind of step aside and say, okay, I'm just going to let them speak. So additionally, it became known that Kansas City Royals GM Dayton Moore orchestrated a partnership with an anti-porn group, Fight the New Drug, which has so far included seminars for players in the organization. The message delivered is that a reduction in pornography consumption will reduce instances of domestic violence and increase overall on-field performances for players. As many have noted in the past several days, the links between porn and domestic violence are tenuous at best, according to the vast majority of studies, which is causing some to question the Royals' approach here. We know that there are issues related to pornography, particularly the exploitative nature of the industry, the manner in which the medium objectifies women, and the way it perpetuates racial fetishization. But this is a baseball podcast, and dwelling too long on porn criticism would really be pushing it in terms of relevance. So instead, we're going to talk about this. What might be a better strategy for baseball teams to reduce instances of domestic violence?
I mean, I think it's all kind of related to just viewing women and non-men as human beings who have rights and who are not just here to be objectified or to, you know, be whatever men want us to be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think another thing that kind of has to happen is that domestic violence incidents really need to be taken very seriously. Right now, you know, we've seen time and time again, you know, players get arrested on charges of domestic violence and then have virtually no punishments when it comes to baseball, or very little punishments. And I think that sends a really bad message. So I think that we need to see teams taking it more seriously when it actually happens. You know, I don't know that that alone is going to, you know, stop people from, engaging in acts of domestic violence in the future. But, you know, if the thought of hitting the person you supposedly love isn't horrible enough on its own, maybe the thought of serious professional ramifications will make it a big enough deterrent.
Yeah, I agree completely. Sort of touching on an article that I wrote last August about how baseball needs to do better about sexual violence and that's perpetuated by its players, one of the things that I recommended is kind of a sponsorship between MLB and, like, Little League, Pony League, and youth baseball programs in general, how MLB can use this opportunity to put forth a program that not only teaches, you know, young kids to play baseball, but also what it means to be a good person. And in that effect, you know, knowing how to treat others regardless of gender, and, you know, being kind and courteous and not continuing the cycle of domestic violence and sexual violence. And I believe that, you know, education needs to start young. You know, a lot of what society has to do is change the way it looks at issues such as domestic violence, and continue these seminars up until, you know, they get to the major leagues. And for players currently in the major leagues, you know, if it's about domestic violence, just have a seminar about domestic violence. Talk about why, you know, people who are not cis men need to be treated with the same regard as a teammate. You know, just frame it in such a context that they would understand that domestic violence and sexual violence and any type of violence against another human being isn't a good thing. And I think there just needs to be a little bit more education in clubhouses about these things, and have someone willing to facilitate these conversations and not just have it as a one-off seminar, but having someone available to answer questions about gendered violence and about just anything regarding the treatment of women and non-cis men. And, you know, it's a continuing education, and while it would be great to just see them begin with a seminar, you know, doesn't matter when, or just, you know, a seminar sometime in spring training or in the regular season, but it would be a good start. And I just think that there's so much more that could be added to what the Royals have started.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I think there just needs to be a fundamental re-education of what domestic violence is, and why it's unacceptable. That kind of goes beyond, oh, it's bad to hit women. Because I think so much of it is just obviously placed on, you know, men hitting women, as opposed to, you know, the emotional, the psychological abuse that is, you know, most of the time present in physical violence as well. And I think there needs to be more of an emphasis put on protecting players, partners, wives, etc., whatever, as opposed to the emphasis being put on, you know, trying to save these players' careers or to save their PR image, because then, you know, it obviously makes women more hesitant to come forward and more hesitant to actually go through with pressing charges, which is already a huge issue.
Yeah, and to kind of add on a little bit to that, just the fact that there are so many women and non-cis men who are unwilling to report, you know, any type of violence because of fear of retribution, that is a very, very big issue. And another one of the things that I think teams should also, you know, very, very explicitly express to their players is that it's not only just a ramification, you know, the consequences of their actions will not only have ramifications on their career, but also to the people that they supposedly love, not just their partner, but if they're, you know, if they're kids, that would also be something that, you know, they may not be aware of, and it's collateral damage. And there is just a lot of different ways that one action can, you know, cause a domino effect. And, you know, just teaching these players that, you know, it only takes like one swing to change so many people's lives, change their lives. And it's not a matter of whether or not, you know, they're still going to be able to have a career, but it's also, will these other people be able to continue living the way that they did before? And I think framing it in such a context that, you know, they're not going to be the only ones affected, is also an important thing to, for them to realize.
Yeah, definitely. It's all connected. You know, it's, you know, you want to emphasize not just the fact that this will affect the players in their lives, but it also affects other people. And then that in turn sort of humanizes people that maybe men have been conditioned to think of as, you know, on a lesser level, even if they don't necessarily think that on a conscious level. So yeah, I think those are all really, important points to sort of bring home. Yeah.
I think, another maybe, you know, tertiary thing is, for teams, for players, for fans to start thinking of these women as their own people and not just so-and-so's wife or so-and-so's girlfriend, to think of them as autonomous human beings that, you know, have lives outside of, you know, just whoever they happen to be dating or married to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of dehumanization and thinking of these women solely as, you know, the significant other of a player and, you know, not just women, but non-cis men in general. But yeah, it's just a case of a lot of people not considering that, you know, they are more than their relationship, that they are autonomous human beings who are capable of making decisions and having their own lives and, you know, whatever decisions they may choose for their lives, you know, doesn't necessarily have any kind of connection to the fact that, okay, yeah, they're with a ball player. That's, you know, that's beside the point. They're still human beings regardless of who they have a relationship with. And I think that's something that a lot of people have a tendency to forget because, you know, when you see a player's significant other, you think, oh, just, you know, that's so-and-so's significant other, without thinking, oh, yeah, they have a name. They're a person themselves. So I think that's also an important thing for fans to realize as well, that, you know, it's not just it's everyone who needs to be a little bit more aware of the ramifications of internalized misogyny in this way and how there's just so many different aspects to what leads to gendered violence and that there's so many ways to combat it. Now, to actually bring things back to baseball, there were a number of free agent signings this past week. This includes Mike Moustakas, Carlos Gonzalez, Lance Lynn, with Mike Moustakas going back to the Royals, Gonzalez going back to the Rockies, and Lynn joining the Twins. Each, shockingly, just managed one-year deals. Another surprise was Adam Lind signing a minor league deal with the Yankees. Given how productive Lind was last year, it seems odd that he could only get a minor league contract. What is there left to even say about this offseason that hasn't been said yet?
I mean, not much. I think all of the issues have been brought up multiple times. There's obviously been somewhat of a lack of acceptance for the issues that people are raising in relation to how teams have gone about this period of free agency with signing players to deals that are less than the players are worth, or signing them to minor league deals when these players could otherwise have received major league contracts. So I think that we're just going to hear the same things again and again until they become more commonly accepted within the baseball community. I don't think that there's anything to add. It's just, you know, these issues have kind of become more apparent with the impending season and with how many free agents still are to be signed. So that's going to be, I think, really interesting to watch the rest of spring training unfold, and hopefully these players will sign for, you know, close to whatever they're worth, and they won't have to take, you know, discounts in either dollars or years because of, you know, the urgency with even signing with a team.
I think one of the most common, I don't want to say defenses, but sort of explanations for what's gone on is that, you know, next season is just going to be an absolute bonanza in terms of free agents that are available. And, you know, in the case of like Moustakas, they're like, oh, well, people, teams are obviously just saving and planning for Manny Machado being a free agent. And while I think that's true to an extent, I don't think that just being like, oh, this offseason is kind of a fluke and, you know, things are going to be different next year. Like, I don't think that alone is sufficient to say, because what happens when something like this happens again? What happens when, you know, you have another offseason that is the year before another really big free agent class with a lot of big names? You know, how do we prevent something like this from happening again? That's kind of the question that I think is what needs to be figured out here.
Yeah, and I will also add that we are almost halfway through March and Jake Arrieta hasn't even been signed yet, and you would think that someone like Jake Arrieta would command at least a 2-year contract somewhere, but nope, still an unsigned free agent. And, you know, Arrieta's not the only one. There's still so many names who have yet to be, you know, heard in conversations about, oh, hey, this team's going to sign this player. And it's just a very, very confusing thing to see that players who would normally get multi-year deals are only getting 1-year deals or minor league deals, and the whole contract with Mike Moustakas is very odd in that he has much more money in the incentives than the base, and that, you know, it has to be a mutual option for someone who is coming off, you know, a very, very good year. And, you know, it's just very bizarre. I mean, going through the rest of the free agents, you know, you have Jake Arrieta. Jose Bautista's mutual option was declined by the club, so he's still a free agent. You know, you've got so many other players on this list who, you know, you look at it and you're like, how is this person still not signed? Yeah, it's just very, very confusing. And I don't know if there's anything left to add to everything that we've said before, because it's just a very confusing situation. And while it seems like there is an answer somewhere, I just don't think we're going to get it this off season.
I do like that we were like, oh, what else is there to say? There's nothing left to say that hasn't been said. But then we still talked about it for like 10 minutes, maybe not 10 minutes. I'm bad at estimating time.
But we still had a lot to say about it.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think especially when you look at Lance Lynn's deal, it's just like, okay, there are so many teams that could have been in on him.
Yeah.
Starting pitching, and they were nowhere to be found, and so we had to settle for this deal.
Yeah, Lynn is, I think, a lot better than people give him credit for, too.
Oh, yeah. Like,
he's been at least above average for quite some time, and even very good in a lot of his seasons, and he's not that old either, you know, so it's kind of like hard to see why teams wouldn't be willing to go at least like to a 3-year deal with him. Like, it's really, yeah, that there, every deal I think is shocking. Like, I think with Moustakas, you know, it's less the 1 year than it is that he got, what, $6.5 million. But yeah, in Lynn's case, it's still kind of unbelievable that no one was willing to go to more than a year for him, at least. You know, not at a rate that he would have accepted.
And it's just so bizarre when we start to get into pitching and the idea that teams might be, like, you know, waiting for, you know, better free agents to hit the market. But, like, teams need 5 starters. So, like, if you get, like, one ace, you know, next year or the year after. Like, that's still four spots that you have to account for. So why not improve those four while you're holding out for this, you know, one player that you think will join your team?
Just to kind of add on to that a little bit, all teams need five starters, except maybe the Rays, who are considering a four-man rotation this season. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, a few teams, like, you know, the Angels and I think the Rangers have been talking about going to a six-man rotation, which, you know, that seemed, I guess, progressive in a way, because, you know, in the past it's been, you know, like, the norm now is a five-man rotation. Before that, it was a four-man rotation. You go back and back and, you know, the number keeps going down. But, yeah, so the fact that the Rays are talking about using a four-man rotation, it's like, all right, we just time warp back to, like, the 60s. That's cool.
I just feel so bad for every single reliever in that organization because they're just going to get burnt out so quickly.
And, like, I think that's one of the advantages of a six-man rotation is that, you know, you give your bullpen a little bit more rest, a little bit more flexibility, and you also give your starters an extra day of rest. And, you know, that can only work to teams' advantages, especially having that extra day of rest. You don't know how well they can pitch. And the four-man rotation, it's just, why? You have all this analysis and data, teams.
It's what killed Sandy Koufax. What are you doing?
Exactly. You could it's like they could have someone who's really great, you know, coming up through the system. Rest in peace, Brent Honeywell's arm right now. And then to ruin their arms with a four-man rotation, what are you... Anyway.
Yeah, it's like there's tanking, and then there's whatever the Rays are doing. Because I think it transcends our idea of, you know, what a tanking team commonly looks like. And it's just gone so far afield that there seems to be, even if we accept that they are, you know, shedding payroll and tanking or whatever, it seems to be some things that don't even quite fit in with that picture.
So anyway, yeah, this off season is in some ways it's waiting for Godot.
Well, we don't need to get too into this, but Bernie Sanders tweeted a picture of himself with Dave Roberts. Bernie's apparently visiting Camelback Ranch, and he is trying out for the Dodgers, according to a tweet that he has posted. And yeah, so I'm curious to see the sort of deal that Bernie Sanders could get in this offseason.
He also tweeted a photo, we're here to bring the Dodgers back to Brooklyn.
And there's also a photo of Bernie Sanders talking about how to grip the bat with Yasiel Puig.
So. Oh, my God. I'm actually scrolling through his Twitter now. This is really weird.
Yeah. He says that he could learn to hit 30 home runs this year, so I don't know what kind of a contract that would get him.
No, I think he's saying Yasiel Puig can hit 30 home runs this year.
Well,
that would be... If Bernie Sanders could hit 30 home runs in this year, he might get the Mike Moustakas deal.
Yeah. They'll put him in the minors and see what he's worth there and then maybe bring him up.
These are tweets I'm definitely not going to read the replies to because I feel like as both just a person with common sense and someone who's a Dodger fan, this is just a recipe for disaster for me.
Yeah. I would stay away from the old replies.
Yeah. But anyway, this is just a weird thing that's happening that I just wanted to note because, yeah, apparently Bernie Sanders has been having conversations with Rich Hill and Andrew Poles, and that's just life, you know?
Yeah. Maybe they'll, like, you know, give him some honorary title or something. Although maybe not if he's like, oh, they should come back to Brooklyn. That might sour things a little bit.
Well, I also just did see a tweet kind of quote tweeting the picture of Sanders talking to Dave Roberts saying, can't believe the Mariners didn't go after him. Fire DePoto. So, then you have baseball Twitter doing its thing.
Yeah, I haven't even ventured out to my timeline yet, but I'm sure I don't even want to say a mess, but I'm sure that there are reactions happening right now.
Yes.
Whether or not they're good or bad reactions remains to be seen. We are now joined by a practicing attorney and Fangraph's own Cheryl Ring to discuss her article that ran this week titled, Can Major League Baseball Legally Exclude a Woman? How are you doing today, Cheryl?
I am just fine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So as we mentioned, you're an attorney and you recently joined Fangraphs to write about legal matters. For our listeners,
I did.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just joined Fangraphs and it is the opportunity of a lifetime.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you on board because it seems like what you do is very different from the sort of content that they had available previously. So it's cool to see them sort of changing it up there. If you don't mind, could you share with us a little bit more of your background and how it is that you came to write about baseball?
Sure. So I'm a consumer rights attorney in the Chicago area. I have my own practice. One of the things that I focus on is class actions, contested litigation, that kind of thing. And I represent people in anything from discrimination cases to small business consulting, and I've done things involving professional sports also. So it kind of runs the gamut. And one of the nice things about Fangraphs is that it gives a really detailed look at how things work in baseball beyond what meets the eye. And one of the things that I thought was perhaps missing a little from Fangraphs is the legal side of that. And Nathaniel did a great job when he was writing articles, and Wendy Thurm also. And I wanted to be able to continue in that tradition and sort of explain the legal side of baseball because it's something that isn't necessarily covered a lot. And I think it's something that's needed.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think there's just so many aspects to baseball that I don't think we really explore a lot of the legal side of things. For those who have yet to read your piece, can you give us a quick summary of what you had written about?
Sure. So the piece is called Why Baseball Can't Legally Exclude a Woman, or Can Baseball Legally Exclude a Woman, to try and give away the lead. But it focuses on a statute called Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And basically the idea is looking at the current state of baseball today, there are about 6,500 players at the major league and minor league level combined, and there are no women anywhere in those 6,500 people. You look at umpires, there's one female umpire among the hundreds of umpires at all baseball levels. Even if you look at front offices, you see a gross underrepresentation of women. And I was looking at, particularly at umpires and players, sort of the on-field focus. Why are there so few women? And more interestingly, from my perspective, is that even legal? If Major League Baseball is, whether it's by design or simply by effect, excluding an entire gender or excluding all people who don't fit one particular gender from the jobs that are on the field, is that legal? And my personal conclusion is I don't think it is, simply because of what Title VII says and what the current law is in the United States.
So what made you interested in exploring this issue related to Title VII and baseball?
Well, you know, I'm a huge baseball fan, have been for my entire life. My wife and I used to watch Pitch every time it was on, and it was my favorite show when it was on. And so I started to get interested in the idea of women in baseball when I was very young, when I wanted to be the first girl baseball player. But even beyond that, after I became an attorney and I was looking at baseball, and I wanted to know, why do we have a situation where we only have men? And I remember following the career of Kim Ng back when she was with the Dodgers and Gene Afterman with the Yankees, and wondering, if you have women who are good enough to be in front offices, there's really no reason why you shouldn't be able to have a similar pipeline for women who want to be umpires, for women who want to be players. And the explanations that were always given to me, especially from the legal side, never seemed to make a lot of sense. So I wanted to do a deep dive, really partially for my own edification, partially for the education of Fangraphs readers, is there actually a legal basis to exclude women? And you go all the way back to Jackie Mitchell and the legend of her striking out Ruth and Gehrig, all the way to the present, and you look at the history of baseball and you see for a long time a concerted effort to exclude women, and then almost this apathy towards women. And that's the kind of discriminatory effect that in, I think, almost any other industry would be the basis for a ton of lawsuits. If you look at, for example, the example I gave to somebody today was if MIT tomorrow just said, well, we have research that says that women are not as good at math or science as men are, so we're not going to scout them, we're not going to recruit them, we're not going to accept them, there would be a ton of lawsuits because that's plainly discriminatory, it's plainly illegal, and you can't do that. But baseball, they basically say that you can. And what I was trying to show is that as a matter of law, there's not really that big of a difference between baseball and any other industry. If you have somebody who can do the job, they should be allowed to do it.
What were some of the legal justifications that you encountered when you were researching this?
Well, the most common one is that being male is what's called a bona fide occupational qualification. And kind of to back up a little and explain what that is, a BFOQ is basically an employer's way of saying to be this certain thing, whether it's gender or whether it's something else, is necessary to do this particular job. So the classic example from law school is always a Hanes underwear model. If you need a Hanes underwear model, you're allowed to ask for only a man because that's a bona fide occupational qualification for the job. But if you're talking about something that's where you don't need to be a man expressly for the position, then you have to prove as the employer that this is something that only men can do. And I don't think that baseball could prove as a matter of law that being a man is necessary to being a good baseball player, which is what they'd have to prove in a court by a preponderance of the evidence. And I don't think baseball could. To put it another way, the question is, is there some population of women out there who have the physical capability to play baseball at a professional level? And I think there were some people who were reading my piece, maybe got confused because this is a very technical area. You don't have to be able to play baseball at the major league level for baseball to be breaking the law here. If baseball is excluding women who are capable of playing at single A, at double A, because they are not men, then that's equally illegal simply because women have the legal right to the same opportunity as men do and to be scouted in the same way as men are.
Yeah, I think, first of all, that a lot of people, like, they just see the issue, like, as presented in the headline, and their inclination is just to be like, oh, you must only be talking about this one thing and not realizing it's a lot more complicated than it is, because, you know, that's how internet readers are. They're so great all the time.
It is. But, you know, I am glad that there were a lot of comments, because my goal with the article was twofold. I wanted to start a conversation about why we don't have women in not just Major League Baseball, but anywhere in affiliated baseball. I wanted to start a conversation about why that is in the 21st century, if this is something that we're really okay with as a country, because this is supposed to be our national pastime. And the second thing was, like I said, I wanted to sort of provide a legal context as to why, at least in my opinion, I don't think that is legal, because we're talking about more than just the major leagues. We're talking about 6,500 players across the majors and minors. And in order for there to be no case that a woman could play in the major leagues, you'd have to prove that no woman could play in the minor leagues also. And I just don't think, as a matter of law, there is a team out there, or Major League Baseball for that matter, that could prove that. And so long as you have some kind of case that women, if they were scouted, if they were developed, could play in the minors alongside men, and I think that the research and some of the research that Jen has done shows that that's clearly possible. So long as that exists, I think that Title VII requires that, as a matter of law, women be scouted also.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, very, you know, passionate about this issue, as, you know, might know, that it's just increasingly frustrating that, you know, there's a lot of essentially, you know, travel baseball leagues with a lot of young girls because, you know, they're not allowed into boys travel baseball leagues or they can't play varsity baseball and whatnot. And there's a lot of good talent there that just don't get the opportunities to be scouted, to the point where a lot of young girls' goals for, you know, baseball past high school is not to, it's not to play in Major League Baseball, it's to make Team USA. So the stakes are very different. So as always, when someone discusses the involvement of, you know, women and non-men in baseball, detractors come out, particularly in the comments section. And while some writers swear against reading the comments, you actually engage. Why do you choose to do that, and how do you deal with some of the more frustrating replies?
I think it's important to engage in the comments because I am trying to start a discussion, and I don't want to be that person who starts a discussion and then isn't willing to defend the points that she made. And I do stand by my article because I think that the points that were raised are not only true, they're also important. And so I wanted to talk to readers and sort of answer their question so that they know that I'm willing to stand by what I said and that this is something that's worthy of a discussion. I think it adds more validity to what you say if you're willing to go in and say, you know what, I wrote this, I stand by it, and here's why. Were some of the comments frustrating? Certainly, but I also don't think it's entirely unexpected, especially in today's society. However, it is a discussion that we have to have, especially now when we're talking about, when we're having these national discussions about equality for women and non-men across the spectrum. It's important to have these discussions about all areas where that lack of equality is being manifested, and baseball is one of those areas. I wish that wasn't the case, but it is unfortunately true. And so long as that's the case, it's important to have a discussion about why that is and what we can do to fix that. Do I think that a lawsuit is the only way to fix it? No. I wish that tomorrow any team would go out and start spending resources scouting women. But do I think that a lawsuit could potentially solve the problem if one were brought? Yes, I do, because I think that the law says what it says, and it says that for a reason.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, you have a great point there about, you know, making sure that, you know, it's a discussion and not just a one-sided conversation and, you know, actually engaging and standing by your point. You know, major props to you for taking the time out of, you know, I'm sure what is a busy schedule to engage with people and, you know, might not be able to change everyone's minds, but, you know, just having that discussion can also open up at least one person's mind. So hopefully,
exactly.
Hopefully, you know, someone out there is, you know, listening or reading and realizing, okay, you have a point there.
I hope so also. Yeah. I hope so also. Thank you.
Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today. Greatly appreciated you coming on here and talking about such an complex issue, and I hope this won't be the last that we talk about, you know, women and gender nonconforming people in baseball. So do I,
and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And now the past week's article summaries. Mary?
Thank you. So on Monday we had Baseball's Connection to MASH by Bruce Markison. As the title suggests, this piece discusses moments from the TV show MASH that pertain to baseball, whether it be listening to a game in an episode, mentioning a team, wearing baseball paraphernalia, or naming patients after baseball players. The piece also discusses the broader connection to baseball stemming from the show's cast and crew, most notably editor, producer, and former Yankee bat boy, Thad Mumford. For those of you who, like Sarah, are working your way through the series now, this piece could be slightly spoilery, but every baseball fan who has completed the series, or perhaps needs a reason to watch it, is sure to get much from this piece. Then on Tuesday, we had Positional Case Study, Seattle Mariners Left Fielders by Alex Remington. In the team's 41-year history, many brilliant position players and pitchers have come and gone from the roster, except for left fielders, the best of which is Raul Ibanez, and the second best is less memorable and less clear. Alex provides the history of Mariners left fielders, a history so bleak, one particular section is titled The Anonymous Bluzz. Just why have the Mariners had such difficulties finding stability at this position? Alex provides several explanations that should prove interesting to all.
Yeah, I just have to say, that whole MASH thing, like, that was, like, weirdly frustrating for me because I was, like, I really want to read this article. I'm super interested in it, but I'm like, ah, oh, man. I just finished season 8, so I still have 3 more seasons to get through. So it may be a few weeks before I can read that. And I know that nobody cares about this, but I just wanted to vent a little because this hurts me on the inside. Anyway, on Wednesday, we had Old English D, a look back at a Tigers uniforms, at Tigers uniform, sorry, by Cliff Corcoran. The Detroit Tigers made a change to their home uniforms this season that is more significant than it may seem to many. The classic Old English D on the cap and the one on the uniform have not matched in the past. However, in 2018, they will, with the version from the cap being the one that wins out. As it turns out, though, the jersey version has been the one in use since the early 20th century, so getting rid of it truly marks the end of an era. In his article, Cliff details the surprisingly fascinating history of the Old English D and tracks how it evolved over the years. Then on Thursday, we have Radio Days, a treasure trove of old-time baseball by Shane Tortolade. How does one handle the baseball withdrawal that the offseason brings? Well, in Shane's case, he listened to a lot of old radio broadcasts of ballgames available on archive.org. These span decades, and Shane shares some of the things he learns from the collection, as well as some of the things he could surmise about its curator. Shane also provides the link to the archive if you want to check it out yourself. And then on Friday, we have Some Physics of Humidors by David Kagan. With MLB experimenting with humidors this season, David looks into what will actually happen with their widespread usage. He argues that, since most teams play in parts of the country that have high humidity in the summer, use of humidors will, on average, lower the humidities of baseball and, in turn, lead to more home runs being hit. Check out the article for the details of his argument and see if it makes you a humidor skeptic.
And this upcoming week, it's Fantasy Preview Week with articles from the Rotographs crew. Jeff Zimmerman will discuss aging curves. Mike Podhorror says, please tell us how to properly pronounce your name because I'm pretty sure we are butchering it. We'll analyze breakouts. Alex Chamberlain looks at ground ball versus fastball pitchers. Paul Sporer dives deep on player usage. And Justin Mason looks at the 10-day DL. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT. And you can find the site on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @jenmacramos. You can find Sarah at @sarahwexler32. You can find Mary @marymcraig. And you can find the podcast on Twitter @thaudio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.